The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading today from the November 8, 2013 edition of The Week magazine. The main stories. The furor over U.S. wiretapping of its allies. What happened? The Obama administration faced a full-scale diplomatic crisis this week after leaked documents revealed that the National Security Agency had for years tapped the cell phone of German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Citing NSA documents stolen by former contractor Edward Snowden, the German media reported that the monitoring of Merkel began in 2002, 3 years before she became chancellor, in an operation run from the U.S. Embassy in Berlin. In a phone call with the German leader, President Obama apologized and said that he would have stopped the bugging had he known about it, according to Merkel's office. But current and former intelligence officials said the White House was not kept in the dark about spying on allies, telling the Los Angeles Times that details of such activities are in daily briefings. Senior administration officials said the president is now considering barring the NSA from spying on leaders of allied nations. Outrage was also growing elsewhere in Europe over media reports that the NSA harvested data from more than 70 million phone calls in France, recording some conversations and collecting numbers dialed, and 60 million more calls in Spain during a one-month period at the end of last year. This type of practice between partners is an assault on privacy, said French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius. NSA Director General Keith Alexander strongly denied those allegations, telling Congress the records had in fact been handed over by European intelligence agencies. What the editorial said. The NSA is out of control, said the New York Times. The agency used to operate on the understanding that international spying was done in pursuit of a concrete threat to national security. But since 9/11, the NSA has acted as if everyone is the enemy, even close allies like Merkel, and that anyone's rights may be degraded in the name of national security. Obama must now rein in this rogue agency or risk permanently damaging our most valued alliances. Nobody doubts that Merkel is America's friend, said the Wall Street Journal. But there are good reasons the U.S. would want to eavesdrop on German chancellors. In the 1970s, a top aide to then-Chancellor Willy Brandt was exposed as a communist agent, forcing Brandt to resign. More recently, Chancellor Gerhard Schröder sought to scupper the U.S. invasion of Iraq by forming a united diplomatic front with France and Russia. That history shows why it's a good idea to keep a close eye on Berlin. What the columnist said. Europeans are faking their outrage, said Max Boot in New York Post. Yes, the NSA probably snoops on their leaders, but their intelligence agencies also snoop on the U.S. government and other allies. All states need as much information as possible about the actions and intentions of other states. And allies have a good reason to spy on one another, said Jack Schaefer in Reuters.com, to confirm that the ally is really an ally. Knowing that they're being watched also keeps friendly nations honest, or at least puts them on notice that their lies might get found out. saying that everyone spies doesn't justify all spying, said David Rothkopf in foreignpolicy.com. Sometimes the risk of being caught are too high, as we saw when the NSA was recently caught hacking into the email of Brazil's president. Soon after, Brazil began talking to Russia, China, and other repressive regimes about increasing local control over internet governance, a development that could destroy the promise of an open internet and the political and economic benefits to the U.S. that might bring. The NSA has become too big for its own good, said Ryan Cooper in WashingtonPost.com. Technological improvements allow the agency to spy on all communication everywhere. But in order to analyze this flood of data, the government has had to expand the security apparatus to an enormous size. More than 4 million people now have security clearances. That's an awful lot of potential leakers. And when the everyday operations of the surveillance state are so controversial, a single leak can cause huge damage to the system. Whatever you feel about Edward Snowden, he's unquestionably demonstrated this fact. And our second main story. The White House promises Obamacare fix in a month. What happened? President Obama's top health official took responsibility this week for what she called the technological debacle that has plagued the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. In testimony before the House Ways and Means Committee, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius blamed inadequate pre-launch testing for the website errors that have prevented people from signing up to the law's exchanges. Hold me accountable for the debacle, she said. In hearings on Obamacare's problems, House Republicans also grilled Sebelius over revelations that many of the 5% of Americans who buy their own insurance plans on the individual market will have to get new plans because of Obamacare rules. The news seems to get worse by the day, said Representative Fred Upton, Republican from Michigan. Americans are scared and may be losing their faith in government. The White House pledged that the site would be fully functional by November 30th, with former budget official Jeff Zients overseeing technological repairs. The administration refused to say how many people had managed to enroll in health care plans since the launch, though it said that 700,000 people had applied. Its goal was to enroll 7 million people in 2014, with a deadline of March 31st to apply for insurance. In a speech in Boston, President Obama admitted that implementing the complex law is hard, but pointed to the success of Massachusetts' similar health care reform, dubbed RomneyCare. Massachusetts has shown that the model works, Obama said. We are going to see this through. What the editorial said. The problems with the website shouldn't discredit the law itself, said the Boston Globe. The glitches are fixable, and the 14 states that are more successfully running their own exchanges prove the system will work. But if the site isn't error-free by December, simple fairness dictates the White House should delay penalties for those who don't sign up in time. The problems with Obamacare aren't glitches, said the Wall Street Journal. They are the inevitable result of political control of the health economy. The bureaucrats in charge didn't designate a single manager to oversee the 55 contractors building the site, and didn't test it properly because they didn't want to admit there might be problems. It's exactly what those of us who opposed Obamacare predicted, and more chaos is coming. What the columnist said. How did the administration screw this up so badly? Asked Megan McArdle in Bloomberg.com. Insiders tell of near-total disconnect between the policymakers and the tech contractors. The policy wonks imagined a Travelocity for health insurance and sent an unending series of complex demands to the tech folks. The tech folks subcontracted the demands out, but since no one person was in charge of the whole mess, they never knew whom to tell of their growing sense of dread. Sebelius should obviously be fired, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. But the real blame for Obamacare lies with the arrogant guy who decided to overhaul the entire healthcare industry. Yes, the administration deserves to be on the hot seat, said Sally Carlson in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. But Republicans are incredible hypocrites for whining about Obamacare's failed introduction, since they did everything possible to sabotage it. Most Republican governors have refused to set up state exchanges, forcing the federal government to take on this burden. Republicans in Congress also blocked funding for contractors and refused to let Sebelius move money around to make up for their obstruction, said Aaron Carroll in CNN.com. Is it really a surprise, then, that the implementation hasn't gone smoothly? If healthcare.gov really is running smoothly by November 30th, said Jonathan Cohn in NewRepublican.com, all the fuss about broken websites will become a historical footnote. But if technical problems persist, the danger is that negative press coverage will scare off the younger, healthier people that the exchanges need in order to balance out older, sicker, new customers. The White House could then fall short of its 2014 enrollment target by millions of people, and that would be a seriously big deal. Our controversy of the week. Drones. Has the U.S. committed war crimes? When drone operator Brandon Bryant went to work in Nevada every morning, he sat down at a console depicting vivid scenes from Afghan and Pakistani villages 7,000 miles away and asked himself, what blank is going to die today? At first, said Matthew Power in GQ, Bryant believed that the drones he operated were a force for good, eliminating terrorists and limiting the suffering of war with their precision. But after 6 years of godlike killing from above, in which he saw a child vaporized on his screen, and hundreds of people get blown into pieces, Bryant's doubts about the morality of his job grew. He turned down a $109,000 bonus to continue as a drone pilot and walked away with a severe case of PTSD. His final kill total, 1,626. The number made me sick to my stomach, he said. The number should sicken all of us, said Kelly James Clark in HuffingtonPost.com. Two new reports from Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch are challenging the myth that drones kill only terrorists, detailing the accidental deaths of hundreds of innocent people around the world, killings that Amnesty says may constitute war crimes. In Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen, our drones' reign of terror has infuriated local populations and proven vastly more effective than Al-Qaeda in turning Muslims against the United States. It isn't quite that simple, said The Economist in an editorial. National polls may show most Pakistanis oppose the drone strikes in their country, but among residents of the tribal badlands along the Afghan border, which is where the strikes are happening, you'll find a sizable minority strongly in favor. Why? For the simple reason, as one elder from North Waziristan put it, that drone attacks are killing the militants who are killing innocent people. Interviews with people in these tribal areas indicate that the human rights groups' estimates are overblown and that the drones do not kill many civilians. The threat from Islamic militants is real, said David Pilling in FT.com, but that does not justify the U.S. mounting a preemptive killing spree from the safety of air-conditioned control centers thousands of miles away. The U.S. can deny killing civilians, but Amnesty's report cites specific people killed, including a 14-year-old boy and a 68-year-old grandmother, obliterated as she picked vegetables next to her grandchildren. And then there's the morally repellent practice of rescuer attacks, launching one drone strike against suspected militants, and then a second strike minutes later to wipe out those who come to the aid of the wounded, on the assumption that they, too, are guilty of something. There is certainly something repulsive about killing by remote control, said Alan Massey in The Scotsman. But there's a more practical way the program could soon backfire. America has no monopoly on drones. Indeed, other nations are already hard at work acquiring this technology. By proclaiming the right to kill perceived enemies in sovereign states, the U.S. has paved the way for China, Russia, and any other foreign government to assassinate escaped dissidents and other enemies abroad. So where are the rules? Asked the New York Times. President Obama promised in May to ratchet back the use of drone strikes and institute tighter guidelines for these killings. But those guidelines have never been made public. Until there is more transparency, Americans have no way of judging whether the government's pursuit of terrorists has led to indiscriminate slaughter by remote control. It was a good week for the Battle of the Bulge, after plastic surgeons reported that growing numbers of U.S. soldiers are requesting liposuction on their bellies so they can beat the Pentagon's body fat test. They come in panicked about being kicked out, said one surgeon. It was a good week for spy versus spy after it was revealed that gift bags Russia handed out to world leaders at the recent G20 summit contained bugged memory sticks and power cables. The Kremlin said the U.S. was trying to divert attention from its own spying. It was a good week for Sultan Kosen, who at 8'3" is the world's tallest man, after he married 5'9" Merv Dibo in Turkey. Everyone told me not to marry him because of his height, said Dibo, but I fell in love with his heart, not his height. It was a bad week for Heinz ketchup after McDonald's announced that the company's condiment would no longer be served at its restaurants because of Heinz management changes. Heinz this summer appointed a former head of Burger King as its CEO. It was a bad week for revenge after a Colorado man testified that he to keep his estranged wife from getting half of their life savings. He converted $500,000 into gold and dumped the gold into a trash bin. Damn right I did, said Earl Ray Jones, age 52. It was a bad week for myths about lightning after Texas rodeo clown Casey Wagner was struck by lightning while hiding from a storm under a tree. When he didn't move, he was struck again. I can tell you one thing, said Wagner. I'm going to start going to church more. In the briefing section this week, Obamacare, son of RomneyCare. The new federal health care law was inspired by Massachusetts' 2006 reform bill. How is RomneyCare working out? What is RomneyCare? On April 12, 2006, then-Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney signed into law the Act Providing Access to Affordable, Quality, Accountable Health Care. That name was too unwieldy, so the bill was nicknamed RomneyCare. The law aimed to fix a big problem. Health care coverage in the state was becoming increasingly unaffordable, in part because of past botched government reforms. In 1996, the state ordered insurance companies to accept all customers with pre-existing conditions. That allowed individuals to stay uninsured until they were ill, depriving insurance companies of the healthy customers they need to subsidize the sick. Premiums spiked, people dropped their costly policies, and Massachusetts' uninsured rate, which was around 7% in the early 1990s, climbed into double digits. To stop the rapid rise of premiums, Democrats and Republicans came together to develop RomneyCare, which would eventually serve as the model for President Obama's Affordable Care Act. What's happened in Massachusetts is a good reflection of what's ahead nationally, said Kosali Simon, a health economist at Indiana University. How are the plans alike? Both laws force insurers to accept customers with pre-existing conditions, offer government subsidies to low earners who buy insurance, and extend Medicaid coverage to poor people who can't afford subsidized insurance. Each law also uses an individual mandate that requires all adults to have coverage or pay a fine, now up to $1,272 in Massachusetts, to prevent free riders on the health care system and ensure there are enough healthy people in the insurance pool. Folks, if you can afford health care, then gosh, you'd better go get it, Romney said in 2006. How was RomneyCare's rollout? It was a mess. The Massachusetts Health Connector, a prototype of the troubled federal insurance exchange, healthcare.gov, was initially overwhelmed by the flood of people who tried to register, and consumers faced months of delays in everything from submitting an application to getting coverage. But the kinks were ironed out, and shortly after the July 1, 2007 deadline for getting coverage, 105,000 people had signed up for insurance, 21,000 more than projected. One of the clear lessons of the Massachusetts experience is that people want affordable health insurance, said Glenn Shore, the Connector's former director and now the state's finance secretary. Today, about 98% of Bay Staters have coverage, the highest rate in the U.S. A 2012 poll found that 62% support the law, while 33% disapprove of it. How has it affected costs? The record there is mixed. The price of a non-group plan rose about 14% nationwide between 2006 and 2009. But on Massachusetts insurance marketplace, it fell 40%. The cost of an employer-sponsored plan has continued to rise in the Bay State, but at a slower rate than the national average. But critics argue that those figures don't tell the whole story, and that taxpayers are footing the bill for the 439,000 people who've acquired insurance since 2006. The Wall Street Journal noted in a recent editorial that health care accounted for 41% of Massachusetts' 2013 budget, up from 25% in 2006. Those costs have forced the state to seek new revenues, and in 2009 it raised the cigarette tax by $1 a pack. The lesson for voters is that universal health care is going to have universally large costs, said the Journal. The middle class will pay the bill, as they are starting to do in Massachusetts. Is RomneyCare a burden for the state? There's a lot of wild accusations that the law is breaking the bank, said Michael Widmer, president of the fiscally conservative Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation. And that is simply not the case. A study by his organization found that additional spending attributable to the reform accounted for only 1.4% of the Commonwealth's $32 billion budget in 2011. Obama's law also raises some taxes, but unlike RomneyCare, aims to pay for the additional insured by cutting health costs in several ways. The way hospitals and doctors are paid is being changed, for example, so that they'll receive a set payment for, say, removing an appendix. that fixed payment removes incentives for ordering unnecessary tests or treatments and encourages providers to make sure patients aren't readmitted because of poor care or infections. Will Obamacare's experience be the same? Not necessarily. The Massachusetts experiment does suggest that the uninsured will eventually sign up in large numbers. But since all major government programs create unforeseen consequences, Massachusetts' Democrat-dominated state legislature has approved 3 technical corrections to RomneyCare since the law passed. Obamacare will also need fixing, especially since a nationwide health care system is far more complicated than a single state's. Rick Lord, president of American Industries of Massachusetts, a business group, is pretty sure no tweaks to Obamacare will get through Congress, where many Republicans want Obamacare to fail. "I'm feeling a little pessimistic about how it's going to play out in Washington," Lord said. Getting preventative care. It's too early to tell if RomneyCare has made Massachusetts a healthier place. There are no studies showing, for instance, whether residents are now living longer. But supporters of the law note that as coverage expanded, more people sought out preventative care, such as diabetes tests, cancer scans, and smoking cessation programs, which have helped 150,000 residents quit since 2006. "I have seen a ton of new patients, all of whom were pretty sick or were going to be sick," said Richard Dupuy, an internist at Boston's Tufts Medical Center. "And now it's all controlled. By tackling health problems early, rather than waiting until patients turn up at emergency rooms with serious and costly illnesses they can't pay for, the state could already be saving money." One Yale University study found that between 2004 and 2008, there was a 2.7% decrease in the number of hospital patients admitted for preventable conditions, such as advanced diabetes, that leads to foot and leg amputations. We'll take a look now at the best columns from the U.S. The first comes from Ramesh Panuru and Rich Lowry at National Review. "The Futility of Apocalyptic Conservatism." If Republicans are to have any chance of winning national elections, said Ramesh Panuru and Rich Lowry, they must turn away from apocalyptic conservative politics. Conservatives mired in the despairing, pessimistic view of politics believe that most Americans have been seduced by big government, and that the only viable response is rebellion and confrontation. Republicans who fail their purity test, they insist, must be driven from the party. It was this philosophy that drove the recent disastrous attempt by the House Republicans to defund Obamacare by shutting down the government. But conservatives lack power in Washington not because of a lack of ideological purity or fire. Our real problem is the insufficient number of our followers. To regain influence and power, conservatives have to persuade voters about the merits of our philosophy and win elections, the way Ronald Reagan did so successfully. We will not win the war of ideas by nominating extremist candidates or by refusing to compromise or accept incremental progress. Conservatives need to get to work of persuading and electioneering and drop the fantasy of a shortcut. The next column, "The Mideast's Forgotten Country," from David Ignatius at the Washington Post. "Does anyone remember Libya?" asked David Ignatius. 2 years ago, the U.S. and its NATO allies spent billions intervening in the country's civil war to topple dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi, hoping to establish Libya as a secure state. Yet Libya is now teetering on the edge of anarchy, with Islamist militias controlling much of the country. Libyan Prime Minister Ali Zaidan can't even hold meetings for fear of participants will be attacked. Zaydin has asked for U.S. help in training a security force to protect the democratically elected government and the delivery of essential services. But the Obama administration and Congress have been paralyzed. Congressional Republicans deserve much of the blame for the inaction because their near-hysterical attacks about the tragic loss of four Americans in Benghazi have made Libya politically radioactive. No one wants to risk another Benghazi, so the U.S. is simply doing nothing. But it does not honor those who died in Benghazi to let Libya fall into anarchy and Islamist terrorism. It's inexcusable to keep sitting on our hands, bickering about Benghazi, while the whole country goes down the drain. And finally, from Leonard Sachs at the Wall Street Journal, on invading your child's privacy. When you buy your kids a smartphone, said Leonard Sachs, you are giving them a powerful weapon. The technology in their hand can be used for bullying, sexting, and life-damaging mistakes. And the person most responsible for that behavior is you, the parent. Consider the recent example of a sixth grader who used her phone to send a fairly mild cleavage shot to her 14-year-old boyfriend. The photo went viral in the community, and the fallout was toxic. Harassed at school, labeled a slut, and shunned by former friends, the 12-year-old crumbled under the abuse, refusing to go to school, repeatedly cutting herself with a razor blade, and contemplating suicide. Similar incidents occur almost daily around the country, but parents are not helpless. We can install software on our kids' smartphones that lets us monitor what photos and messages they post and tell them we're doing so. Isn't that a violation of their privacy? No, because there is no privacy online. It's extremely important for kids to know that any photo or message they send via the internet may wind up being seen by the whole world, including mom and dad. Our last Word article this week is titled, A Deadly Habit. We know we shouldn't text and drive, said Leon Nefak, but our phones are programming us to do just that. Drive for long enough in America and you're bound to see someone texting behind the wheel. Maybe it'll be the guy ahead of you, his head bobbing up and down as he tries to balance his attention between his screen and his windshield. Or maybe it'll be the woman weaving into your lane, thumbing at her phone while she holds it above the dashboard. Maybe it'll be you. A recent study by Virginia Tech Transportation Institute showed that drivers who are texting are twice as likely to crash or almost crash as those who are focused on the road. It's a disturbingly common habit. According to another survey, nearly one-third of American adults have emailed or texted on their phones while driving at least once during the previous month. And while most get away with it unscathed, many do not. The National Safety Council estimates that 213,000 car crashes in the United States in 2011 involved drivers who were texting, up from 160,000 the year before. Concerned Americans have taken up the fight against this national epidemic, as U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood called it. 41 states have outlawed texting while driving, and police are experimenting with increasingly aggressive enforcement strategies. Meanwhile, advocacy groups are taking a page from past public safety successes, like the push to get people to wear seat belts and the anti-drunk driving movement. But there's a problem with treating the texting and driving threat as simply a matter of public awareness. Most people already know they shouldn't do it. One federal survey showed that 94% of Americans think it should be illegal to text while driving, yet they persist. Among teens, who are twice as likely as adults to have extended text conversations while driving, the problem is particularly worrisome, According to one analysis, a state anti-texting law barely reduces the likelihood a teenager will text and drive. It seems clear something powerful is at work, overriding people's knowledge that what they're doing behind the wheel is dangerous. To figure out what that something might be, psychology and communications researchers around the world have started studying what exactly is happening in our heads when we reach for a phone in the car. What the research so far suggests is that texting and driving is unlike any public safety issue we've dealt with before. It's not like the judgment error of drinking too much and deciding to drive home anyway. It's not like neglecting to put on your seatbelt. That's because at the center of the problem, the experts say, is an entirely new kind of object, the modern smartphone, that has become embedded in our consciousness in a way that's changing our behavior on a massive scale. In this light, the deadly phenomenon of texting and driving is just one manifestation of a broader affliction facing society. Our phones have effectively programmed us with new habits, including a powerful urge to pull them out when we're not supposed to. That urge to check our email, to glance at Facebook, to see who just texted us, can be as intense as we're standing in line or at dinner with our families as it is when we're driving a car. But it's only in a car that resisting it becomes a matter of life and death. In order to fight the problem, we need to understand how that urge works and acknowledge that merely telling people texting and driving is dangerous and punishing them for doing it might not be enough. You have to start with the question of why it happens, said Scott Campbell, a communications professor at the University of Michigan. Once you have a grasp on why it happens, then you can start to attack the actual mechanisms that lead to the behavior. Without that, you're just experimenting. Driving is hard. A lot can go wrong as you operate a 2-ton vehicle in a parking lot, never mind at highway speed. Not surprisingly, paying attention to a small computer at the same time makes it much more likely you'll mess up. And while sending or reading a text message might only take a few seconds, that can be an eternity when you consider how little time it takes for a child to run into the street or for traffic to suddenly slow in front of you. In a car, getting distracted even briefly can be catastrophic. In 2011, official reports listed 387,000 people injured and 3,031 people killed as a result of distracted driving. The remedy seems simple. Drivers should just decide to ignore their phones in their car. But as cell phone researchers look more deeply into the practice, they are concluding that decision-making may only be part of the story. For many people, they say, using a smartphone may be less a decision than a habit, a move they make without initially thinking about what they're doing or why. Habits form when we do something so often that it becomes automatic, sometimes even compulsive or involuntary. Researchers who study the psychology of habit formation are finding that for many people, cell phone use fits this category perfectly. In a recent paper, researchers reported that results of an experiment in which 136 test subjects were given smartphones equipped with software that kept track of their usage for 6 weeks. The subjects pulled out their devices for very brief periods of time of up to 60 times per day and tended to interact with them in ways that met several definitions of habitual behavior. In diary entries, subjects indicated they were moved to pull up certain applications under the same circumstances over and over. Those who repeatedly checked their email or looked at the news, for instance, said they consistently did so when they got bored. People whose cell phone use is driven by such automated habits are more likely to text and drive, according to a paper published earlier this year. In the paper, researchers asked 441 college students a series of questions aimed at determining the extent to which their phone use was habitual. Those who scored high on the scale tended to be the same people who admitted to texting while driving on a regular basis. The tricky thing about fighting habitual behavior is that the brain's ability to form habits is actually one of its strengths. A habit is a powerful shortcut that helps us stay more productive. If we learn to react automatically to things in our environment, we preserve mental energy for the harder decisions. You don't want to have to think about it every time you turn out the lights and lock the front door in the morning. Phones, however, may hold a power over our habitual behavior that we haven't fully appreciated yet. Psychologists believe habits tend to revolve around triggers. Settling into our desks at work, we automatically check for messages. But researchers who have looked closely at the way we use our mobile phones say the habits people form around the everything boxes in our pockets are fundamentally different, because we use them in so many different situations and to accomplish so many different tasks. We develop a vast range of triggers and cues associated with pulling them out and looking at them. These triggers can be quite basic: the phone ringing or buzzing with a message, and they can come from inside as well as out. One's desire to reach for the phone might be rooted in complex emotions like loneliness and curiosity, for instance. Humans crave resolution, and smartphones offer it. It's hard to resist seeing whether a crush has texted back or a coworker has sent a reply to a crucial email. By connecting us to everybody we know, all the time, smartphones present a novel way to scratch all kinds of itches. At the heart of the texting and driving problem, according to researchers, is that people who habitually use their cell phones in daily life have a hard time stopping themselves from reaching to that multitude of triggers when they're behind the wheel. The idea that you can just turn off all those associations when you go into the car, I just don't think it's realistic, said Stephen O'Connor, a psychologist at Western Kentucky University, who recently co-authored a paper linking compulsive cell phone use to a heightened rate of crashes. Worse yet, driving itself may exacerbate the problem. According to Paul Atchley, a psychologist at the University of Kansas who studies texting and driving, drivers are at a disadvantage when it comes to resisting temptation because their prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain responsible for inhibition, is engaged in the task of driving. The part of your brain that would say, "Don't do this, this is bad for you," is occupied, he said. If smartphone use has become more automatic than conscious for a broad swath of the population, it suggests a complete solution to the problem will require more than laws and ad campaigns. What people who text and drive must do is change their behavior in a way that's akin to kicking a compulsion. One approach to these kinds of compulsive behaviors is to simply remove the temptation, the way a smoker might throw away his lighter and avoid hanging out with other smokers. An idea that's been floated recently is to have phones automatically shut off when they detect they're being used in a moving car. In fact, one can already download apps that do this. But until it becomes possible to teach a phone to distinguish between a driver and a passenger, such solutions are unlikely to gain traction. Atchley argues for a campaign inspired by the "friends don't let friends drive drunk" approach to reducing drunken driving. If it's a social problem, the solution has to be a social solution, Atchley said. That could include abstaining from contacting people we suspect are driving, though obviously much of the time we have no idea, or getting passengers to crack down on drivers. But it could also involve drawing lines around about phone use in other contexts as well, essentially training ourselves to distinguish between situations where it is and isn't okay. If we think it's socially unacceptable to have one person in a group constantly playing with their phone, said Atchley, it's our responsibility as a friend to say, "Can you put the phone down and just hang out with us?" Another idea suggested by the new research is that we might fight habit with habit. The goal would be to develop a new trigger for turning the phone off, or even stashing it in the trunk before getting into the driver's seat. Ultimately, researchers agree, figuring out how to stop grabbing for our phones will depend on recognizing that we're relating to this new technology with some very ancient instincts, and that we'll need to take those into account, not just fight them. It is a new kind of problem, said Campbell, and in a way it's the same old problem we've always faced as human beings. That underlying need to connect, to overcome those boundaries between self and other, what I'd call the human condition. This was adapted from a piece that originally appeared in the Boston Globe. On the health and science page, a breakthrough in growing human hair. Scientists have grown new hair on hairless human skin for the first time, offering hope for a real cure for baldness. Researchers had previously succeeded in getting the hair-growing dermal papilla cells of mice to reproduce in petri dishes and yield new follicles when transplanted back to the rodents. But they could never get similar human cells to form the microscopic clumps that seem to allow these mouse cells to develop properly and sprout hair. We began thinking that maybe if we could get the human cells to aggregate like the mouse cells, that might be a step toward getting them to form new follicles, Columbia University hair geneticist Angela Cristiano tells sciencemag.org. Her team achieved just that by culturing the cells in hanging droplets rather than on flat petri dishes, allowing the cells to touch one another in three dimensions and exchange the signals necessary to fully develop. Those cells then created follicles that produced strands of entirely new hair. This could lead to a major advance over existing baldness treatments, which transplant hair from one part of the head to another. Cristiano hopes to begin testing the new method in human clinical trials within 3 to 5 years. Sleep washes the brain. Why do people and animals sleep? This question has long puzzled scientists and sparked several competing theories. A new study on mice claims to have found the answer. The brain physically cleans itself during sleep, essentially running a nighttime rinse cycle that flushes out toxins that build up during the day. The brain only has limited energy at its disposal, and it appears that it must choose between two different functional states, awake and aware, or asleep and cleaning up, University of Rochester neurologist Maiken Nedergaard tells BBC.com. She found that during sleep, the cells in a mouse's brain shrink dramatically, increasing the space between them by some 60%. That allows cerebrospinal fluid to circulate more freely and wash away cellular waste. Upon waking, the brain cells enlarge and the flow slows to a trickle. Among the residue removed from the brain during sleep is beta amyloid, a plaque-like substance that is a hallmark of Alzheimer's. Nedergaard said it's probably no coincidence that diseases associated with dementia are linked to sleep disorders, raising the possibility that adequate sleep may be important in slowing the progression of brain damage. On the Talking Points page, marijuana, the new pro-weed majority. Before long, marijuana will finally be legal everywhere in the U.S., said Nick Gillespie in Time.com. For the first time, a Gallup poll has found a majority of Americans support the full legalization of marijuana. In fact, 58% now favor legal weed, a stunning 10-point increase in just a year. It's the latest indicator that the federal war on weed, which officially began in 1937, is finally drawing to a close. What's amazing is just how quickly public opinion on this is changing, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com. Only 31% favored legalization in 2000. At the current rate of increase, support for legal marijuana will hit 65% in 3 years. Two states, Colorado and Washington, have already passed voter initiatives legalizing weed for recreational use. Add it all up, and marijuana will probably be legal in most of the country by 2020. So who will be the first national politician to come out in favor of legal weed? Said Nate Cohn in NewRepublic.com. Hillary Clinton, in particular, could win over young, independent male voters in 2016 by taking a bold stand on marijuana legalization. But don't count on it. A third of Democrats and two-thirds of Republicans still oppose legalizing pot. For the next few years, politicians will continue to worry that there are more votes to be lost than won by supporting marijuana. The legalization movement may also run into some setbacks, said Emilian Thompson-DeVoe in Prospect.org. The first legal marijuana shops will open Colorado and Washington next year. If there's a highly publicized misstep in either state, such as a surge in adolescents coming to school stoned, or glassy-eyed drivers crashing into trees, Americans could quickly turn against legalization. History suggests that won't happen, said Adam Nagourney in the New York Times. When California legalized medical marijuana 17 years ago, critics predicted the state would see increased lawlessness and a drastic rise in other drug use. Those warnings have proved unfounded. Instead, research suggests marijuana has become an alcohol substitute for younger people. Many law enforcement officials still worry about rising rates of marijuana dependency and younger teens regularly using the drug. But Mark Kleiman, a marijuana policy expert at the University of California, Los Angeles, says the state's experience indicates that legalizing cannabis is obviously a good idea. Alcohol is so much more of a problem than cannabis has ever been. The religious right, pulling back from politics? Evangelical Christians are pulling back from the fray, said Neil King Jr. in the Wall Street Journal. After 3 decades of intense political activism, the Christian right is conceding that it has lost its battle to roll back the sexual revolution, and that its strident condemnation of homosexuality and premarital sex is driving away large numbers of younger Christians. Russell Moore, the 42-year-old public voice of the Southern Baptist Convention, is now warning Christians to avoid becoming mascots for any political faction, and advising a kind and emphatic, empathetic message. When the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act in June, Moore's message to his organization's 45,000-member churches was, "Love your gay and lesbian neighbors." What an incredible turnabout, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. Today, most Christians under 40 no longer find the old hardliners' positions on sex education, contraception, and marriage equality even vaguely plausible, let alone humane. If the killing of unborn children and the spreading of sham marriage doesn't qualify as an urgent reason for Christians to participate in politics, said George Neumeyer in Spectator.org, what does? Moore's message seems to be backward Christian soldiers. A true religious leader would not consult polls to find out whether or not to protect the unborn and God's plan for marriage. Such frustration is understandable, said Rod Dreher in The American Conservative. But the reality we Christians must face is that our old strategy of condemnation and confrontation has failed. So evangelicals have a choice. Neumeyer's angry nostalgia for a time when our side seemed to be winning the battles, or Moore's strategic engagement with the world as it is today. The word strategic doesn't mean surrender, said Abby Oltheiser in TheAtlantic.com. If you look at Moore's statements carefully, he isn't asking Christians to give up on activism. He's asking them to promote their beliefs in a more PR-friendly way. Take the pro-life movement. It has attracted many young Christians who promote adoption, counsel pregnant women to carry to term, and warn that abortion will scar them emotionally, all while pushing for the same controversial laws restricting women's access to abortion. To see the white flag of surrender in the religious right's change of tone merely indicates the power of progressive wishful thinking. And a few short notes. Dozens of new books on John F. Kennedy are being published to coincide with the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination on November 22nd. Since 1963, there have been more than 40,000 books published on JFK. Almost 40% of American babies under age 2 now use a smartphone or tablet before they can speak full sentences, a new survey found. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that children aged 2 and under should have no screen time at all. Over the past 10 years, 94% of large federal information technology projects were unsuccessful, according to a study by the research firm The Standish Group. More than half of them were either delayed or over budget or fell short of user expectations. And finally, a quote from John Quincy Adams. If your actions inspire others to dream more, learn more, do more, and become more, you are a leader. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.